Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gerardo Poli.
And this, sorry. Okay.
I'm Gerardo Poli.
I'm Hubert Himstra, and this is The Vet Vault.
We're thrilled to have with us Professor Alice Defarge from Ontario Veterinary College at the University of Guelph. Alice is a professor of small animal internal medicine, and in this episode, she tells us how to work up and successfully diagnose cases with non-hemolytic anemia, and specifically gastrointestinal bleeding.
Our guest today is brought to you by Elicam. Elicam is the world's first veterinary capsule endoscopy unit. In part two of this episode, we'll get right into the weeds of capsule endoscopy and how to use it in diagnosing, amongst other things, cases of chronic anemia and suspected GI bleeding. If you can't wait until then, go check it out at forlimb.com.au.
That's forlimb.com.au, four as in the number four.
/Elicam. In Australia and New Zealand, Elicam is distributed by forlimb Surgical Solutions right here from Western Australia. Forlimb has been supplying veterinary equipment in Australia and New Zealand for the past 7 years. They pride themselves on forming close working relationships with their clients. That's you, the veterinarians and nurses. And if you ever find yourself at Perth, go and see Sebastian, the founder of Forlimb, and ask him for a coffee. He makes what has to be the best coffee in all of Perth, down to roasting and grinding his own beans. And that's the sort of attention to detail that you'll see in all of your dealings with him. I don't know if I should put that in, but it's true. He does make a fucking bean cup of coffee.
I love it. You should leave that bit in. As part of sponsoring this episode, Forlimb is offering a 10% discount off your first Elicam order. For more information, check out forlimb.com.au/Elicam, A-L-I-C-A-M. Sebastian and his team are more than happy to discuss any questions. Just mention the podcast or enter the discount code VV for Vet Vault at the checkout to get your 10% discount. And if you're thinking this sounds like it's only for large referral hospitals and specialists, no, there's many uses for this in general practice. Now, let's get back to our episode.
Alice, thank you so much for joining us on The Vet Vault. We look forward to picking your brains.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I'm super excited.
So Alice, in a recent episode, or one of our other clinical episodes, we discussed immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. And in that episode, we covered a lot of the basics of anemia, of how to recognize an anemia case and how to do that initial workup. And then in that episode, then we went down the rabbit hole of the hemolytic anemias, specifically IMHA. And if any of our listeners want to recap that, go and listen to our episode with Dr. Dave and IMHA. But today, we want to talk a little bit more about the regenerative anemias that are non-hemolytic, and specifically then how to diagnose them. I personally find these quite challenging. You get these cases, and they're easy initially because you do your clinical examination and your first bloods, and you go, yes, they're anemic, and okay, that's easy. And then you go, okay, well, they're not hemolytic. It's not an IMHA. They haven't had a massive bleed somewhere. Oh, crap, now what? So I know sort of what's wrong, but I don't know why. And then you get stuck and you go, where to now? So I think it's a great episode to talk about. But can we start with a quick recap of how we're going to differentiate between a hemolytic and a non-hemolytic anemia? I've done my physical examination. I've got my bloods in front of me. What am I going to see in each of those cases to send me in the right direction?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I actually saw three cases, at least that I can remember in the last 3 months, that would have been challenging for me. So it's very complicated because the dogs are presented for the same, sometimes for the same clinical signs. So they can have sometimes melena, both of them. They can have hematemesis, or sometimes even they can just have like vague signs like anorexia, lethargy. And on the blood work, you see anemia. And we can be very quick at jumping on into the hemolytic hypothesis, although there are some clues that can help you to make the difference. So on the CBC, for example, you could look at the characteristic or of the anemia. It's very it's very tempting to just look at the hematocrit and see that the red blood cells are low and then the PCV is low and then jump into the easiest diagnostic, which would be like the IMHA. Mm. But actually, when you look a little bit deeper into the blood work, there are some clues that can help you. For example, if you look for IMHA, there is a destruction of red blood cells. And so on the biochemistry, you can see increased bilirubin usually. On the biochemistry, I also look at the proteins, because if there is a blood loss, then the protein will be low. Mm-hmm. In IMHA, the proteins are not getting low because there is no blood loss. There is just destruction of the red blood cells.
Mm, yeah.
So this is the first thing I look at, is the protein and the bilirubin. And then on the CBC, there are a lot of clues that you could look at. So first, the hematocrit, of course. Then I also look at the smear, and I think anyone can look at a smear if I can. I'm not a good pathologist at all. I'm not specialized in that at all. It's very easy to look for abnormal red blood cells. I think even a kid could do it. Like you compare red blood cells to an abnormal red blood cells, and it's not the same shape. It's not regular. So, for example, you could look for spherocytes. Spherocytes are smaller red blood cells that have lost their central paler, so they're darker, they're smaller, and they don't look like normal red blood cells. So anyone can look at it, look at the smear, and see that there are spherocytes. Spherocytes are the result of destruction of red blood cells, but the red blood cells have not been eaten up, so they're still in circulation. So this is a clue that there is some destruction. And if there are spherocytes, then you're more looking at a destruction process than a blood loss. The second thing you could look at on a CBC is some abnormal red blood cells that look like ghost cells. It's not very scientific, but it's actually called that by the clinical specialist, ghost cells. So they are very, very pale. And it's like you're seeing just the membrane of the red blood cells and nothing inside. It's white,
yeah.
And you just see the membrane of the red blood cells. So that could be another clue. And I think on your CBC, there are some values that we all ignore because they look very intimidating.
Yep.
So they're called MCV, MCHC, and you're oh my God, what is that? But they're actually very useful. And I learned that with time, that they're, if you really look at them, they will give you a lot of clues. So for example, the MCV, it's the mean cell volume. That just means that the size of the cells can be normal. Mm. If the MCV is normal, it can be increased if the red blood cell is bigger than normal. And it can be decreased because the red blood cell is smaller than normal. So it's a big, big clue, because if you have destruction of the red blood cells and the bone marrow is working well, then the bone marrow will build some more red blood cells, but will release them very, very early to balance the destruction of red blood cells. So the red blood cell will not be mature, so they will be bigger. So the MCV will be higher. Now, if you have a chronic blood loss, for example, GI blood loss, then the anemia is chronic, the iron storage is decreasing, and then the red blood cells are smaller. So after several months of chronic anemia, then the MCV will be smaller because just the red blood cells are smaller. Mm-hmm. So if you have anemia and you don't have spherocytes, you don't have high bilirubin, look at those intimidating parameters on the CBC, and they can give you a lot of clues. There is another one, RDW. It's the percentage of different size of red blood cells. And if it's increased, that means that a lot of red blood cells are not the same size. And probably that means that there are small and big red blood cells. Mm-hmm. And that could be related with a destruction of red blood cells.
Okay, cool. So that sounds nice and straightforward when you say it like that, but it can get a bit complicated sometimes. Are there things there that can mislead you, or is it always pretty clear cut? What are the things that are gonna catch us out when we're looking at these?
So the fact that I think the most important thing I look at is the hallmark of blood loss, chronic blood loss, is decreased hematocrit, decreased protein as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you may have like clinical signs that, like, for example, melena, hematemesis, hematochezia, so any trace of blood in stools or vomit would be another indication that there is a blood loss. And people tend to also ignore the urinary blood loss. And when you have chronic urinary blood loss, like hematuria, that can lead to profound chronic anemia as well.
I remember hearing, and actually, you know, this was my own thinking about a couple of years back. And it was like, oh, they're not bleeding into the gastrointestinal tract because they don't have melena, or that they're not vomiting blood. So let's look elsewhere. Let's do, you know, ultrasounds, like ultrasounds, x-ray, part of it, right? But I used to kind of think that, oh, they're here anemic. If they were this anemic, then they should have black tarry feces or blood coming out of their vomit. Like, I felt that I was actually, like, over time I realized I was wrong and actually then told that I was wrong. Is that the case, or should you see it easily, or?
Yeah, you're right, because it happened to me as well. Like, I had several cases where I was sure that it was not, like, the case was bleeding from the GI tract, from the gut, because he didn't have any dark tarry stool or any blood in the vomit or in the stools. And actually, I looked that up, and I found a very interesting study, interesting and kind of disgusting at the same time. So somebody, it was a long time ago, I think we would have not had the right to do that anymore now, but they made, like, people ingest like 100 mls of blood or 150 mls of blood or lower than that, and then they looked at their stools. And yeah, no, that's pretty disgusting, I know, but the good thing is that they did it, so we don't have to do it anymore. So they actually proved that until you drink like 150 mls of blood, you don't have any dark tarry stool. So that means that our PET will be the same. Yeah. It takes a lot of blood lost in the gut to have like melena or fresh blood in the stool or fresh blood in the vomit. So it takes like half a cup, which is like big.
That's a lot. So if it's just chronically leaking in there, but never at those sort of volumes, you're not going to see it necessarily. And that's important. I'm with Gerardo because I'm still a bit like that. I'm like, well, it's anemic. It's not hemolytic, but there's no blood in the stool. So where the hell is it bleeding? But it doesn't, clearly it doesn't mean, because you can't see it, doesn't mean it's there.
Exactly. And on top of that, I had like one case who was transfusion dependent. And some days he didn't have any dark tarry stools, although he was really like losing some blood. And when we started like cutting the stool with a wood stick, and we could see that there were blood inside the stool. So sometimes it's just like you need to manipulate as well the stool to see it.
Yeah, because I've had clients that come in and then they say, like, their dog's, you know, weak and lethargic. And then my thought process was like, okay, if they get this bad, they must have melena or like dark tarry feces all the time. And it was like intermittent, like mostly normal and some kind of dark jelly stuff. And then it was normal again and so forth. And it kind of screwed my head. It's like, so they can kind of have intermittent episodes of it or something, or?
Yes. So it's very common that they have intermittent episodes. And actually recently now that we can actually like diagnose like GI bleeding more easily, we're seeing like more cases who do not have any clinical signs of gut bleeding and who have like proven like GI bleeding, like macroscopically in the gut, and we can see it inside their gut.
I want to ask you quickly, it's something I'd learned about, I've never really done it, the fecal occult blood test. Is that going to be useful for those? Like if you suspect there's gut bleeding, is that something you do?
Yeah, so I do it because it's sensitive. So if you have a negative fecal occult blood test, it's usually because they're not bleeding. But if it's positive, then it could be falsely positive because the dog eat like food based on meat. So ideally, you need to fast them. And you need to remember that the fecal local blood test, it's not made to be used in dogs. So it's made based on the hemoglobin of the people, human hemoglobin. So it detects the hemoglobin of people and not the hemoglobin of dogs. So it's not 100% sensitive nor specific. So you need to be very careful with that. And so if I have a dog who does not seem to be bleeding from the gut and I do it to rule it out, I would believe it. If now my dog is transfusion dependent and I really think that he's bleeding from the gut, if the result is negative, I know that this test is not very sensitive so for dogs, so I would not rule it out.
Okay, so it's useful in context, I suppose.
Yeah, but so. you can't rely on it completely. Can I take you back a little bit, back just to the blood work? You said something, so if you're bleeding into the gut, you said it after a couple of months, you'll run out of iron and you start seeing those ghost cells and those sort of signs. I just picked up the month. Does it take that long? Like if you start having, you've got an ulcer in your gut and you start losing blood through your gut, how long will it take until you start seeing the classic chronic blood loss anemia signs? And this in as a part of that question, in that interim, what's that blood going to look like? What's your diagnostics going to look like?
So the big difficulty with those dogs with GI bleeding is that at the beginning, the anemia can be normocytic, normochromic. So the anemia will look like not like a GI blood loss. So the volume of the red blood cells will be normal. The content of hemoglobin will be normal because the iron is still there. So everybody is expecting a dog with GI bleeding to be hyperchromic and microcytic. But only a fourth of them present those characteristics of anemia. So it takes like 2 or 3 months for a dog to have like this characteristic pathognomonic like anemia.
Wow.
And there are nice studies like showing that 3/4 of them do have like anemia that are normocytic, normochromic. So you cannot rule it out based on that.
So it could take it quite a long time to get that classic picture, small cells, pale, and I knew that. I didn't realize it took that long.
So what is going to be your telltale thing? Is it going to be the protein, the drop in protein that's going to make you think, we're losing blood, or how are you going to pick those?
So I look at the low protein with the low hematocrit. I'm more looking at the absence of clues that would make me think that there is IMHA. So if there are no spherocytes, no ghost cell, no abnormal red blood cells somewhere on the smear, if the bilirubin is normal, if the protein and hematocrit are changing at the same rate, then I would think that there is probably GI loss. If there is asynchrony with the changes of hematocrit and protein, that's why I'm thinking probably there is red blood cell destruction.
Okay.
And then obviously that's combined with like urinalysis and, you know, an AFAST, look for effusions or something, or, you know, ultrasound or x-rays or something like that as well to rule out that kind of cavity stuff.
Exactly. So for GI blood loss, we usually do AFAST, CFAST. We usually check the urine to know if there is like hematuria. Sometimes it's not microscopic. Sometimes you just see like microscopic hematuria on the urinalysis. So it's very important to do a urinalysis as well. You're right.
Mm.
You mentioned urine blood loss. How much blood do you have to pee out before you start getting anemic? Is it the same thing? Can it be more occult, or is it going to be much more obvious?
It can be occult, but I've not come across like any study like the other one for urine. So I cannot give you any example for that. Mm. I'm glad that nobody did it, but no, the urine, the only cases I've seen so far, they were having intermittent microscopic bleeding. So the client could see
yes,
like pinkish urine intermittently, but they were anemic because of it. So it could happen as well.
Oh, they're those tricky ones. Intermittently, you come in, you get a cysto sample, and there's nothing there. You're like, are you sure? And they're like, there was definitely in the cherry photo. And you're like, yeah, I hate those ones. That's a whole nother rabbit. Like, that's a rabbit hole there. Let's just not go down that way.
So we're talking about GI bleeding now, whether it's visible or more occult. What causes it? What are we going to see in practice that's going to spark this? What are the most common things that you see?
So there were numerous studies in dogs that have shown that the most common like cause of GI bleeding is ulcers. Mm-hmm. So GI ulcers, secondary to the use of anti-inflammatory drugs, like even the new generation of anti-inflammatory drugs. So not to name like that specifically, but Metacam, Ansior, like any like non-steroidal like anti-inflammatory drugs. Or steroids. So the big mistake of a lot of people is to think that new generation anti-inflammatory drugs are safe. It's not true. Like chronic treatment can be actually like detrimental, and I think we underestimate a lot the side effects of these drugs.
I remember listening to a veterinary pharmacologist, and because that was one of the questions he had, it was about intoxications, and he's talking about NSAIDs. And then one slide he had was that, like, the increased level of selectivity, this is 1,000 times more selective for, what is it, COX-2 or something. I can't remember now, COX-1 or COX-2, right? Like, and then, no, this one is 32,000 times more selective, like, because in human medicine, they'll have ones which are, like, super selective. And then, it was like almost the same in terms of side effects, like
really?
The propensity. Right? Yeah. So.
Yeah, you know why they have more side effects? They have actually more side effects with a new generation like anti-inflammatory drug because people are less cautious. They take less like gastroprotectant.
Wow. So you mentioned the steroids. Please help, because now I'm so confused about steroids and gastric ulceration, or let's say GI ulceration. Do they cause? Or can they cause ulceration, or do they just worsen them? I've gotten so confused about this.
So they are inhibiting the cascade of arachidonic acid. Uh-huh. So they're inhibiting like the COX-1 and COX-2 as well. They're interfering with the protective process of the gut.
Mm. Can that in itself cause ulceration, or do you then need another insult to actually cause the ulceration?
So the study, there is not like clear pathophysiologic like explanation to that. They think that they interact with prostaglandin secretion, and prostaglandin can be protective for the gut. But they also showed in a multiple like study that, for example, the dog with IVDD, so herniated disc and hypotension, could be predisposed for a GI ulceration. Mm-hmm. So there are several like explanation, but in some cases, it seems that you need to have an insult to increase the risk of having GI ulceration secondary to steroids. Mm-hmm. It could be secondary to an insult, but even without an insult, it seems that they can be deleterious for the gut as well.
Okay. We're going to leave that here for this week. In the next episode, we will go into a lot more detail about confirming our diagnosis by using imaging of the gastrointestinal tract. We look forward to speaking to you then. Remember to go and check out the show notes at thevetvault.com. And if you wanted to find out a bit more about Alicam and our sponsors, go to forlim.com.au/Alicam. That's FOUR, like the number 4. We'll see you next time.